Hello and welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and we're going to start the program off today talking about what's known as community-supported agriculture, or CSAs. And I have with me in studio Jennifer Reeve. She is the director of the USU Student Organic Farm, and they've had a CSA since about, what, 2008?
2009 was the first year we started it, yes.
So why don't you just explain what is a CSA?
All right. Well, a CSA is basically a marketing concept that links the customer directly with the farmer. And so at the beginning of the season, the farmer will advertise their shares and with maybe a list of prices or anyway come to an agreement with their customers up front on what a share of produce over the course of the growing season is going to be. And so then the consumer or the customer makes that commitment to the farmer to purchase that produce for that season. And that really, it helps share the risk, especially for small farms who are otherwise might struggle competing in the marketplace.
So one of the biggest advantages I'm seeing first is you are buying local produce. You're getting it fresh.
Right.
In many cases, you're getting it on the day that it was picked.
Exactly, yes.
Do you get a choice of what you get, or is it usually this is your particular share and you don't choose what comes in the box?
That really depends on the CSA. There's a wide variety of models, wide range of models on how exactly this works. Some CSAs will have everything prepackaged for you in a box and you don't get to choose, while others you'll sort of walk into their area and they'll have a whole range of things displayed and you might have a bag that you fill with what you like. And so, or maybe there might be a list saying you get X bunches of lettuce and X bunches of arugula, but you can choose between tomatoes and eggplant or something like that.
And maybe
really
no
depends.
More than one clamshell of strawberries.
Right.
Because everybody's going to want the strawberries, but nobody wants to necessarily get the eggplant.
Right. So. That might be the case. Right?
Okay. Yeah. So how much do you usually get in a particular, is it once a week?
Once a week is very common. And typically CSAs will provide what's known as a full share or a half share. And a full share, we like to think about it as enough produce to feed a family of 4 to 6, and a half share, 2 to 3.
Okay, so if you're single or a couple, mm-hmm. don't have any kids at home, then you can get a half share. So,
right.
'Cause that's the one thing that I do hear most often is, I don't want to do that because it's way too much produce and I can't eat it.
Right. Yeah, and often it is weight. Because the other thing that happens is in a CSA is the volume might vary with the time of year.
Okay.
Right? So early in the season, especially in Utah when it's cold and, you know, plants are growing slowly still, we might be more constrained with the size of the shares. But definitely in August and September, there's a bounty of everything. So
typically, how much does a share cost? I know it's going to be different with each one, but
right.
just on average, if you can give a range.
On average, maybe a full share, $500, $600 for maybe 20 weeks of produce, and a half share, $300.
Okay.
$350.
And is Those that paid the, up front, or do you pay monthly?
Again, that varies. Some growers like their customers to pay up front, and others have installment plans. We are the student farm. We have a two-payment plan, but we went away from the monthly payment just because it was so much work following up and trying to get the payments on a timely scale.
The credit card doesn't work.
Yes.
I understand that here.
Right.
Okay. So I can see that one of the advantages for the farmer is they're able to, if they're getting their money up front, they're not having to worry about that during the greatest time when they need to be out in the field and they're taking care of everything there is to take care of.
Exactly. One of the biggest challenges for small market gardeners is that all the work goes into growing the produce, and when it's ripe, they have no idea who else is growing it and what the competition is going to be and what the prices are going to be. Mm. And so it's a way of providing them a guaranteed market, really.
Do you know how many CSAs there are in Utah?
I don't.
There's quite a number. What about Cache Valley?
Cache Valley, there's 2 or 3, I believe, and it changes every year, but maybe more than that.
So the biggest question would be, how do you find out where the nearest CSA is to you.
Right. And you can go online. There's various websites that will list the CSAs in your local area. The farmers market, many of the vendors at the farmers market, Cache Valley Growers Market, also run CSAs, and they'll have signs up outside their booths, and some of them even have a display basket of what a typical share looks like. So the growers market's also a really good place to get to know your local growers and find out who is offering a CSA.
Now, there is csautah.org, although I'm just trying the website this morning and it wasn't working, and so that has a list. Mm-hmm. But there's also a website called localharvest.org, and if you go to localharvest.org/CSA, you can put in your town or your zip code, and it will pop up with the different CSAs in that particular area. And so CSAs, for the most part, are for profit because you're purchasing directly from the farmer. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, the farmer is trying to make a living, and so it's not a non-profit organization. It's just a way to help support local farms that have really been going out of business at a very quite alarming rate. It's hard to compete in agriculture, and I think historically, at least, we've had the attitude get big or get out, and there were a lot of people who were worried what this was doing to the farm community landscape, and were looking for different ways to connect customers to their food directly, so that less of the profit went to the middleman and the supermarket, and you also had that relationship. You knew where your farm food was grown. You could maybe help out. Many CSAs will give you the opportunity to help with harvest or other activities. They might have community activities on the farm, so it really just becomes very much of a social community atmosphere around it.
If I didn't have my own garden, I would find that very advantageous to send my own children to go and work on the farm, as it were, like my parents used to be able to do. Mm-hmm. So they had that understanding and that connection with the land, with the soil, and where their food comes from.
Exactly.
It's not the grocery store. That's the middleman. It's mm-hmm. from this soil. And if you know the farmer, trust that farmer. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe you have your bot. I'm just guessing your body takes advantage of that a little bit better because it knows that you're trusting where that's coming from.
And I think there's research actually that shows that children are more likely to eat their vegetables when they feel that connection with having either helped grow it themselves or have seen the vegetables growing in the field. Then it becomes interesting, right? Mm. And they want to try it. So.
But we are taking questions. We're live. And if you'd like to call in with a comment or question, it's 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We have about 3 or 4 more minutes that we're going to talk about community-supported agriculture. And Dr. Jennifer Reeve is the director of the USU Student Organic Farm. And CSAs, they're becoming more and more of them. And one of the things I wondered about, are usually most of them organic, or is it again, that depends on the CSA?
Historically, CSAs were almost all organic or biodynamic, but that is changing. And now really you get a whole variety of different approaches. I think most CSAs have a commitment to farming sustainably and really trying to integrate management practices in a way that's healthy for the soil and the environment, and they may or may not be certified, or they may or may not be using 100% organic practices.
But those are questions that you can ask as you look around.
Exactly.
And CSAs are not just about produce. There are different types of CSAs.
There are different types of CSAs. Some offer fruit in addition to the vegetables. Some offer eggs or meat or flowers. And some CSAs, some farmers actually get together to to contribute produce to that basket. So the produce or the different food products might be coming from different farms.
Now, are they delivered or do you pick up? Or again, is it a little bit of both, depending on the CSA?
It really depends. Some CSA, most will do a bit of both. They'll have a pickup location at the farm, but then they might have a pickup location at the farmer's market or at the local food co-op or community center, something like that.
So you use the word basket. So I need to ask you, mm-hmm. So what's the difference? I know what the difference is because mm-hmm. I've bought from this, but Bountiful Baskets mm-hmm. is available all throughout. It's been mm-hmm. expanding quite a bit.
Yes.
And you said before the program, people will say, well, how come you don't have tomatoes? Bountiful Baskets has tomatoes.
Right.
And that's because that produce is not coming from local.
Exactly. I think there's actually been a confusion about the difference between a CSA and the Bountiful Basket or other basket schemes, because the basket schemes, they're really putting together all sorts of different products from the regular food distributors, and it's a convenience thing. It's provided year-round. Well, the CSA is locally harvested fresh produce produced on that farm, you know, as it's grown. And so in Utah, for example, we don't have tomatoes in May.
Yes, this doesn't work.
Right, right.
Now, do you have high tunnels so you can start beginning your growing your produce earlier and extend the season?
We do, yes. And in fact, they've been very important for us in allowing us to start our CSA in mid-May. We could probably do it even earlier, but with the student farm, we typically let the students finish the semester, have a couple of weeks to get themselves organized. But we're growing this produce as we speak. You know, it'll be transplanted out into the hoop houses in another couple of weeks or so.
Do you ever take requests? Like people want to see a certain type of vegetable grown? Or
yes.
How do you determine what you plant?
Well, the students decide, you know, every spring semester we get together and we have planning meetings and decide what to grow. And that's partly based on our experience of what's done well in the past, or we might want to try a little something new this year if the students are excited and trying to grow kohlrabi, for example, right? But then we also will ask our CSA members from the previous season what they would like to see more of, if there was anything new they would like to try, or if there was anything they'd like to see less of.
How do you keep the deer out? Because you're in a location where there are, I mean, when if I happen to be staying after the sun goes down, I have to watch as I'm driving north on 800 East as I go past the garden, because there's deer leaping through there all the time, and I see them in the winter pawing through trying to find what they can.
The deer have been our largest problem. I have driven out there in the morning and found 30 deer all standing right in the USU organic farm, which is a larger, nearly 5-acre plot, which is for research, organic research, as well as the student farm CSA. And they can be a real problem. They will take a bite out of almost every single melon if they get a chance.
And that's the other thing. They don't eat the whole thing.
No.
They just paw into it, take a couple bites, go on to the next one.
Exactly.
They don't eat everything on their plate.
No, and we tried putting up a fence, but they can be incredibly persistent. I saw a deer throwing itself repeatedly against the fence until it broke down.
Oh, my.
And so we didn't want to use barbed wire for that reason. And so our solution has been to cover everything. And so we cover all our transplants with row cover or netting of various kinds.
Well, and this brings up part of the shared risk with CSAs,
right?
Because the farmer, if you happen to have a hailstorm and lose all of your peppers for some reason,
mm-hmm.
Then everyone shares in that risk.
Risk
instead of just one person.
Exactly.
And if you have lots of deer, everyone shares in that risk. Do you have, when something like that happens, if you have hail, the fruit is still edible or the vegetables are still edible, mm-hmm. can you still sell them, but just at a reduced cost?
Well, we would, because we don't sell our different products individually to the CSA. They pay a bulk price for everything. If we have lots of damaged produce, We'll typically put it in a basket and have it available for people to choose if they would like.
Because we're such a visually based society, but again, having my own garden, it's like, oh, there's a couple of divots in it. It's just fine.
Yes, it makes no difference to how it tastes.
Well, I really have appreciated you coming in to talk about CSAs. Mm-hmm. Been listening to Dr. Jennifer Reeve. She is the director of USU's Student Organic Farm, and you can learn more about a community-supported agriculture or CSA by going to localharvest.org/CSA, and you can type in your city to find out the nearest CSA to you. Jennifer, thanks again for coming
in. Thank you.
We're going to have a quick break, and then we'll be back talking about Hellstrip gardening, so stay tuned. Welcome back to this portion of The Zesty Garden. My next interview is with the author of Hellstrip Gardening, Create a Paradise Between the Sidewalk and the Curb. It's by Evelyn Haddon. And Evelyn is on the line with me, and we're going to talk about what you can do with that strip of property that usually has either rocks or grass in it that's between the sidewalk and the street, or maybe even between your driveway and the neighbor's driveway, a way to beautify it, and especially in Utah, not use a lot of water at all. And Evelyn, thanks for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, Brian. I've been looking forward to this.
I understand you're in Washington right now?
I am. I'm at the Northwest Flower and Garden Show.
Well, send some rain our way, or snow especially. We really need it right now, and this is a great time to talk about this as we prepare for the summer season. So why the book? Why did the idea come to you to do this?
Actually, Timber Press came to me and asked me to write it. They were very interested in doing a book on Hellstrip gardening, and immediately when they brought up the topic, I could imagine doing a whole book about it, because since I started thinking about gardens and writing about gardens, I have noticed those little fragments of land that are sort of leftovers, and oftentimes the lawn in them, if there is one, is really not very well kept up, or it just can't grow very well in those places. And I've often thought, wow, they could be put to much better use. They could really be rewarding if they were planted with something else.
In your experience, have you found any of these places either too small or too large to really to plant with well?
Oh, heavens no. I'm of the opinion that there's a plant for every place. You know, there's more than one plant for every place. It's just a matter of figuring out what the conditions are, or maybe modifying them if it's a smaller place, and then finding the plants that work with that place.
And in Utah, they're usually called the parking strip. So I just want to make sure that people understand that we're talking about the same thing when we talk about Hellstrip gardening. It's like parking strips in Utah. I'm not sure why. That's just regionally that's what they're called here. And one of the things that I have to make mention of, certain cities in Utah restrict what can go into these. Now, I think it's getting better, but have you found that around the country as well, that sometimes you run into zoning laws that restrict you from doing anything other than what is either in that covenant or in the regulations from the city?
Oh, sure. There are great variations regionally, both in what the Hellstrip is called and in what you can plant in it or cannot plant in it, or how you what structures you can put in it, if any, or even who owns it. So it is good to check with your city and figure out if there are any rules that you would be abiding by when you're developing your Hellstrip.
So usually you see grass. What's the first thing you're going to do when you think, okay, I want to take this grass out? So you've checked with the city, you found it's going to be okay. What I have a tendency to do is get rid of the grass and then do the planting, but that's kind of backwards.
You can, it depends how you want to get rid of the grass. Now, if you're going to get rid of the grass by digging it up so that you'll be able to plant right away, then you should have your design ready to go. But if you're going to get rid of the grass by, say, smothering it or solarizing it with black plastic, then that will take some time, so you could do that first. And as it's dying, you can be designing your parking strip.
I'm working with an area that is about 40 feet long and about 6 to 7 feet wide that is between my driveway and the neighbor's driveway, and I just want to make sure I have as drought tolerant of plants as I can get, but keep color the whole year round, which I know is possible. But I have field bindweed. Mm-hmm. What am I? My biggest worry is putting these plants in, but not keeping the bindweed out. Any suggestions?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't use chemicals on my own garden. I am experimenting also with how to move things away from being bindweed controlled. I understand that it doesn't necessarily grow well in shade, so there's possibilities there for putting more dense, taller plants in that would shade it out. Other than that, I don't really have an easy magic wand solution for you. I'm sorry.
For most of these health strips, do you recommend keeping them open, or would you put down plastic or some kind of mulch to try to keep the weeds down? And then just plant as you can within that.
I'm a fan of not using plastic in a planting bed. It's just so hard to deal with if you have to move anything around or change anything. I am a big fan of mulching and also of using living mulches to cover the ground, because the more that you can cover the ground, the better you can retain soil moisture and protect the soil against erosion and that sort of thing. So I feel like it's a healthier solution.
And part of one of the other drawbacks about black plastic is if you want your area to naturalize with seeds dropping from the plants or the plant expanding, that doesn't work. You don't get that naturalized look.
Right. And, if you want your garden to be thriving, I really do feel like sometimes a garden will look like it's more healthy if there are some seedlings or if there is a little spread of the plants, if it looks like they can actually reproduce on their own.
Your book is a couple hundred pages, almost 300 pages.
I'm wordy.
But it's not wordy. It's full color, lots of full color photographs all over that show you the different types of plants, plus being able to look at various types of health strip gardening. And your first area you talk about in the book is inspirations. And this is kind of helpful because I'm thinking, okay, I don't necessarily want to plant something from Portland, Oregon, because you list the cities, but I might like to take some kind of design elements from something in Portland and then plant plants that are more specific to my area.
And that's the intention. You can use these design inspirations with any appropriate plants to your climate or your region. The point is that you can plant a water-wise health strip, and it can be in a variety of styles. You use your own style and your own preferences so that it makes a garden that you love.
And we were talking about one of the challenges, of course, with the weeds. What other types of challenges do you have to overcome as you're getting ready to put in your plants? What things should you be on the lookout for?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is if you already have a tree in your health strip. That's a tough one. You want to work around the roots, and you want to make sure that you choose companion plants that don't compete too heavily with the tree, so that it stays healthy and they can stay healthy as well. So that's a big one. And, of course, in Utah, water is a big challenge, and so I'm very interested in ways that you can save water or develop a landscape that doesn't use as much water, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are as well.
Many of the landscapes in Utah have irrigation already into those sections, and that's part of the problem is that the water comes on every time you turn on the sprinklers. They're usually timed, and so you can get too much water into these areas especially. Do you recommend just capping those off or just putting on a drip emitter to water your plants in these areas?
You can do either one. A lot of times the solution will depend. It'll depend on what kind of garden you put in and what kind of landscaping you have in the rest of your yard. Of course, ideally, you'd develop all of your yard into a water-wise landscape, and then if you do have sprinklers or irrigation system, then it could be changed, adjusted, so that it wasn't watering very often, just as often as they need. You have some great resources, waterwiseplants.utah.gov. There's a whole plant list and an explanation of how you might change your watering system depending on what kinds of plants that you put in and how often you plan to water.
And the USU Extension website is great as well. They've developed several different books on the types of plants, how to plant them, how to put them in. So in a companion with what you've got here, which is showing what you can do in the health strip, I think you could find it, any information that you'd need to have to put something like this in.
That's great to have those kinds of resources that are so specific to the local area.
I'm thinking about when you are designing this area. I mean, you don't have to worry about the dimensions because it's usually pretty typically restricted, mm-hmm. but you do have to worry about what happens once the plants begin to grow. So, for instance, if you have cars that park right next to this area, you're probably not going to put, say, a Russian sage right on the very edge of it.
Yes, I do spend a chapter talking about access, and that's a good point that you want to make sure that people can park and get out of their cars and be able to walk across this parking strip if needed so that they can reach your house or the sidewalk. So you would want to put periodic pathways for them and also maybe think about is a car door going to run into your plant or is a person going to be carrying something and need to have a way to get across that parking strip without being able to look down. So, you do have to think about those kinds of things as you're designing.
What about the wildlife? I'm thinking this could be something to really attract birds, especially, and insects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, if you have a street tree, it does provide really good habitat for wildlife. Birds are a great example. Pollinators are another one. There's a pollinator pathway here in Seattle that's been developed over 1 mile between two larger green spaces, and the people who live on that stretch have all developed their parking strips so that the pollinators can travel along them between the two green spaces.
Mm. And what about the soil? What should you be looking at in the soil? Is it worth having a soil test done first before you begin?
Well, again, it depends. I mean, if you're thinking this is the only sunny area of my yard, I'm going to need to grow some edibles here, then yes, you definitely would want a soil test, and you'd probably just want to plan on bringing in new soil, because if your road has been around for a while, then chances are that lead and other pollutants from the vehicle traffic have accumulated in that soil, and they don't go away. Hmm. But if you're planting, ornamentals, something to just give you year-round color like you suggested, then I don't know that would be necessary. If you've been gardening for a while, you probably know your soil pretty well, and you could figure out what grows there. What would grow there and what wouldn't grow there.
I'm talking with Evelyn Haddon. She's the author of Health Strip Gardening, Create a Paradise Between the Sidewalk and the Curb, and it's from Timber Press. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. And we have a question from Hillary. She's via email. She says, does the book include plants for the Intermountain West?
It does. It includes plants for all over the country. It doesn't specifically have a section on the Intermountain West, but it has a plant dictionary at the back that's separated into plants with showy flowers, plants with showy foliage, plants for culinary and medical uses, and plants for four-season structure. And each of those little plant listings has an idea of where the plants would grow and what kinds of conditions they would want.
And Hillary,
so it's not specifically for your region.
So you need to kind of know a little bit more about what plants grow well in your area. And so you were mentioning that website before of plants for Utah.
Definitely. And if you go to a nursery that is participating in the WaterWise plant tagging program, The nurseries actually have tags on the plants that show which ones are water-wise, and you can kind of just pick up the ones with those tags and feel pretty comfortable that they would work with less water.
Our emailer, Hillary, also mentioned, and this is for the city of Logan, so I'm assuming there might be other areas as well, but Logan City must approve any tree selection for the park strip, and they will, at least Logan, will not approve quaking aspen, which I heartily applaud.
Yes, and that's pretty common for urban areas to have their own requirements about which trees to plant. And that's a good thing to think carefully about anyway. Trees require really careful thought before you would put them in, especially in an area where you might have overhead power lines or underground utilities.
And you wouldn't especially want to have a tree that's planted that begins, the roots begin to lift up the sidewalk, for instance.
No, or a tree that would drop things on you.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about was usually this area is going, it's hill strip, so you're thinking heat. So the plants that are going to go into this area need to be able to take a little more heat than just, you don't want to just put any plant in there.
That's true. There is that urban heat island effect when pavement is nearby. And that can be a blessing, too. You can get earlier bloom, you know, from some of those little bulbs and things. So it can kind of, you can look at it both ways, as a challenge and a blessing.
I'm thinking growing tomatoes. that would be a big blessing.
Yes.
Do you see a lot of these that are grown in vegetables rather than in flowers or other plants?
It depends. So sometimes the yard will be shady because there will be trees, and the only sunny place might be out on the hill strip or out by the driveway. And so, yes, in those cases, those gardeners are so grateful to find a place with sunshine that they might take, you know, spend the extra effort it requires to develop these places into nice vegetable gardens.
Who
wouldn't want homegrown tomatoes?
Oh, I know. Well, the other thing is it's on the sidewalk. Maybe some folks might help themselves, too. And depending on how many tomatoes you plant, that might not be a bad idea.
That can be a really nice idea. That can really make a neighborhood feel welcoming. That can really change the experience of pedestrians. You know, so I'm an advocate of sort of planning to share.
If you had just a couple of plants to choose to put into an area like this, what would you start with?
Oh, you're asking me tough questions. it depends on what you want. You know, really, if you want year-round color like you're suggesting, I would go for, and if you're sort of a typical gardener in a typical neighborhood where maybe you're the first one to try developing your, mm-hmm. your hill strip or your parking strip, I'd go for plants that are kind of lower and showier and with persistent foliage. So I'm a fan of Basket of Gold, Arenia saxatilis. It has nice persistent foliage and beautiful yellow flowers, and it's very easy care. I like sea lavender. That's also a really nice Limonium latifolium. Coral bells can do well if they're not exposed to too much wind, and they always have really nice foliage and blooms, but they're a little bit pickier if they get too dry. Mm. Bearberry has lovely foliage, I think, and a really nice year-round structure to it. So those are just some of my favorites.
Great. Well, Evelyn, we've reached the end of our time. I really appreciate you joining me on the program today. I've been speaking with Evelyn Haddon. She's author of Hillstrip Gardening, Create a Paradise Between the Sidewalk and the Curb, and it's available from Timber Press. Thank you, Evelyn.
Thank you so much, Brian.
And stay tuned for the next portion of Zesty Garden coming up, and it is our newest segment, Bug Bites. You're listening to the Bug Bites module of the Zesty Garden. Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, is in studio with me. And today we're going to talk about green alternatives that may control stink bugs but also help monarch butterflies. And this is a good example of what we've talked about on the program before, which is IPM management.
Right, yeah. So IPM stands for Integrated Pest Management, and that's actually the general field that I work in here in Utah. I work in research and extension. Extension is outreach to the public and trying to help them with, in this case, improving the management of their insects and related pests. And so integrated, as the name suggests, means kind of looking at using multiple approaches and integrating them together to make, you know, the whole better than the sum of its parts. So that kind of synergistic, anything you can do to make, you know, bring it all together and make a comprehensive, well-rounded, solid kind of pest management program. And it's not just applied to agriculture, although that's where I think about a lot because that's what I work in. But it can be applied to school IPM, you know, indoor structural pests, forest pests, all kinds of situations.
Well, and in this case, what jumped out at me was the monarch butterflies part, mm-hmm. because, you know, whatever I can do to help boost the monarch butterfly populations would be great. So why don't you explain what's happening with this, the stink bug? This is taking place in the South. Farmers are concerned about their cotton mm-hmm. and their, what other crops did they have going on?
So peanuts were the other, that's right. the other crop that they talked about. So this is a group of entomologists that are in Georgia and in the southeastern United States. Cotton is a popular crop to grow. It's a good cash crop to grow there. And there's a complex of stink bugs. So these are, I think some of them are native species, but some of them are also introduced species that are problems on the cotton. And what they do is they are attracted, especially around the edge of the cotton fields, and they move in, they lay their eggs, and those stink bug nymphs, the little young stink bugs, will feed on the developing cotton flower, which then turns into the stage I call the square, which is like the bud, and then, the bud comes first, and then the flower, and then, you know, ultimately the cotton bowl will develop. That's a hard word to say, bowl. And when the stink bug feeds on that, it damages the fibers in the cotton bowl, and you don't get the nice, white, fluffy cotton. You get a kind of a shriveled bowl, and you don't get the yeast yield out of that you would like to get out of a healthy cotton bowl. And so, pesticides, insecticides have been the primary control for stink bugs. Stink bugs are pretty difficult insect to kill. They're like little tanks. The adults are good flyers. We talked before the show about how there's such a high dispersing insect. They fly all around. They use all different kinds of plants to feed on and lay their eggs. And so they're just a hard insect to kill. And so agriculture has primarily relied on synthetic pyrethroid insecticides, which are pretty good at killing on contact. But the problem when we use a lot of these insecticides is that we're killing all the beneficial insects too. And so that's where integrated pest management tries to come in and say, what else can we do? You know, we know that just relying on insecticides is not sustainable. It's not going to, you know, we're going to create more problems sometimes than we solve. So what else can we do? So this group in Georgia looked at bringing in plants, so alternative plants that could be used as a screen or a border or divider between and around fields. And because cotton are particularly at risk for the stink bug damage, but they'll feed on peanuts and alfalfa and other, you know, plants that are grown nearby, but they're flying into cotton because they really like it. So they looked at planting these screens of plants, so sorghum, a type of grass that can grow pretty tall was one thing they looked at. They also looked at just using some plastic screen, some material they could like put up like a screen you might see around the edge of a when you're trying to keep erosion from going down mm-hmm. into the creek or something. And they found that as long as the screens, whether it was plant-based or plastic, was at least as tall as the cotton crop, which was around 4.5 feet when it was mature, that it worked pretty well. And it really helped reduce the numbers of stink bugs that were flying into the cotton field and causing damage. And so, and that greatly reduced the amount of insecticides they had to use. So that was one of the components. And the other thing they looked at was, well, what happens if we can plant something that would draw some of the beneficial insects in that will attack the stink bugs? And so they looked at two different kinds of flowering plants. One was buckwheat and one was milkweed that you were talking about, the monarch factor in this. And so when buckwheat or milkweed were flowering, it was attractive to a particular parasitic fly that attacks the stink bugs. And so they got much better biological control of the stink bugs when they had the flowering buckwheat or milkweed. But then they saw this one additional benefit, which was really cool, was that when they had milkweed there and flowering, they saw a lot more monarch butterflies and caterpillars in the area. And so we know, as you were saying at the beginning of this module, that monarchs have been particularly hard hit by agricultural practices. A lot of it has to do with reducing weeds, because milkweed often grows as a weedy plant around field edges, and it's common in open pastures and fields. But when we cultivate the land and grow the corn and the soybeans and the different things we plant, we often kill off that milkweed. And so the monarch needs a kind of a continuous mosaic of host plants of the milkweed to migrate across North America. And if we disrupt that with big gaps where there isn't much milkweed, that's what really hurts their population. So this research showed that, hey, we can target a big pest in cotton, stink bugs. We can use alternative controls, insecticides, and protect the pollinators and the natural enemies. We can plant some particular flowering plants, and one being milkweed, we can plant, and we can help the monarch as well as help ourselves, so to speak, with the stink bug biocontrol.
Is there any indication that planting milkweed would attract other insects? So here in Utah, for instance, that would help with some predatory insect that we don't want?
That's a good question. I don't know that there's been any other. There are, when I look at milkweed around, there's three main insects I tend to see. There's two different kinds of beetles that are called milkweed beetles. One is a cobalt blue color. Another one is a red, big longhorn beetle.
Long antennae
with the black spots on it. But those are both milkweed specialists, and they're not harmful to any other plant. So they're there because the milkweed's there. But then another insect I often see is called the ambush bug. And this is a brightly colored predatory bug, and it's there to feed on other things that are on the milkweed, obviously. Probably not so much the beetles, because they're big, but maybe, aphids and other smaller insects. So maybe something, the question you ask, I don't have a specific answer, but I do know that I see ambush bugs on milkweed. So it could be that, yes, they could be helping draw in another predator, generalist predator, that could help with control of pests around on the plants nearby. So perhaps so.
Great. Well, we were talking about green alternatives that may control stink bugs, but also help monarch butterflies. That was this particular article. And if you want to have more information about this, you can go to Entomology Today and sign up for their little newsletter. It's like a little an email that you get once every day or so that talks about different fascinating news in the world of insects. Diane, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks, Brian.
You've been listening to Bug Bites, part of the Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. In 1942, more than 110,000 Japanese Americans were forced to 16 internment camps across the western U.S. 8,000 of them went to the hastily constructed camp of Topaz, 16 miles northwest of Delta. Here, these Americans stayed for 3 years, forced to remain behind barbed wire in a forbidding landscape of greasewood, extreme temperatures, and little vegetation on a high-elevation alkali flat. Many of these Japanese Americans were from the Bay Area near San Francisco, where they had made their living from the land, including the selling of produce. While limited with what would grow in the terrible soil, they did attempt to grow gardens and beautify the grounds around which they lived. In today's Petals and Prose, Helen Cannon gives more details into the life of the occupants of Topaz.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. And today I wanted to talk with you about something that doesn't seem to be related to flowers, but actually is. When I was a little girl, maybe 7 or 8, I was traveling with my parents, and we, for some reason, were near Delta. And I looked out the window and saw all of these children with their noses pressed against a tall wire fence with barbed wire at the top. And that image has stayed with me and haunted me. I asked my father, why are those children behind wire? And so my father, who had been part of the occupation troops in Japan after the Second World War, he said those are Japanese Americans who have been imprisoned here for no good reason. And I thought about that, and the image stayed with me, but I didn't really hear precisely what that was until later. At the time, I was dating Richard Merrill, who was the son of Milt Merrill, after whom the one library is named. And one day we went to visit Richard's grandmother, Laura Merrill, and he explained to me that she had been volunteer teaching at Topaz, the internment camp near Delta. And so I became even more interested. My next exposure to Topaz was when Leonard Arrington, an excellent historian, his book on Topaz came out. The name of it is The Price of Prejudice. And he explains very clearly what this was and why. This is how he begins. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor December 7th, 1941, persons of Japanese descent were living in the United States, of whom more than 112,000 were on the Pacific coast. These could be conveniently divided into three groups: the Isai, or immigrants born in Japan, the Nisai, or American-born, American-educated children of the Isai, and the Kibai, who were born in America but received some of their education in Japan. Permanently excluded from becoming American citizens by United States law and seriously limited in their ability to acquire agricultural and residential property by alien land laws, the 40,000 Isai had nevertheless lived here for more than 25 years, had raised their children, and achieved a recognized position in the retail and wholesale distribution of fruits and vegetables in California, and displayed every intention of remaining here with their children to live out their days in peace and comfort. The 70,000 Nisai, on the other hand, were predominantly teenagers and young adults, and in speech, dress, and manner, as well as in ideals and attitudes, were indistinguishable from other Americans of the same age. 20,000 of the Nisai had been to Japan at some time or other, mostly as youngsters for brief childhood visits or a little schooling. Less than 9,000, however, were Kibai, who had received three or more years of education and, quote, indoctrination, unquote, in Japan after the age of 13. While most of these passionately and totally rejected Japanese civilization, a few conscientiously and defiantly identified themselves with it, leading some American authorities to believe that their primary allegiance was not to America but to the Emperor of Japan. As the United States awoke to the devastating reality of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, a series of measures were taken which affected these persons of Japanese ancestry. Some 1,500, quote, enemy aliens who were thought to have connections with Japan were immediately rounded up and interned by the Department of Justice. Their businesses were closed and their bank accounts blocked. The remainder, both citizens and aliens, were required to register and carry identification cards and to turn over to local police all contraband, cameras, radios, binoculars, firearms. They were also frozen to within 5-mile radius of their homes and required to be in their homes between the hours of 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. In the succeeding weeks, as Japan launched successful assaults against the Philippines, Thailand, and Singapore, the American public became increasingly suspicious of persons of Japanese ancestry in the United States. Indeed, despite a traditional belief in tolerance and fair play, Americans, particularly Californians, had never regarded Japanese immigrants with special favor. Some individuals had long encouraged the view that the Japanese could not be assimilated, that they represented a racially undesirable element in American life, and that they imperiled the nation by their biological fertility. Of particular influence in the formulation of public attitudes was the widely publicized but completely unsubstantiated rumors of sabotage and fifth column activity in Hawaii in connection with the Pearl Harbor attack. Reports of enemy submarine activity off the coast of California added to the mounting sense of panic. Fearful of an invasion of the continent and increasingly conscious of the dangers of resident Japanese sabotage, citizens on the West Coast demanded strong precautionary measures, that even the most conscientious Americans were vulnerable to the growing hysteria is illustrated by a column written from San Francisco by Walter Lippmann. This is quoting that famous radio man's comment. The Pacific coast is in imminent danger of a combined attack from within and from without. It is true that since an outbreak of the Japanese war, there has been no important sabotage on the Pacific coast. From what we know about Fifth Column in Europe, this is not, as some have liked to think, a sign that there is nothing to be feared. It is a sign that the blow is well organized and that is held back until it can be struck with maximum effect. I am sure I understand fully and appreciate thoroughly the unwillingness of Washington to adopt a policy of mass evacuation and internment of all those who are technically on the Pacific coast. The Pacific coast is officially a combat zone. Some part of it may at any moment be a battlefield. Nobody's constitutional rights include the right to reside and do business on a battlefield, and nobody ought to be on a battlefield who has no good reason for being there. And so this opinion grew and grew until the government decided to round up these Japanese Americans and have them leave all of their possessions except what they could carry in a suitcase, and took them to various camps across the country and into Canada. Next time, I'll talk more about this and how they made do with growing things, even in the barren land of topaz. I'll close with just one quotation that relates to that. This man was on a field trip to Topaz for students who had never been there. It was a miserably cold Saturday, but that too led to a poignant moment. Can you imagine how cold those barracks must have been? In spite of the wind, the students continued to walk over the camp, picking up remnants and listening to Wendy's father talk about the camp. He had been fighting in the Pacific, came home from the war, and had a job as a fireman at the camp before it closed. He said, "Every freedom I had been fighting for was violated in my own backyard." He showed us the floor of the firehouse, pointed out the administration building foundation, and noted that the Japanese gardeners were even able to grow flowers there in that alkaline soil. I hope to be able to continue this sad story, but inspirational story next time. So tune in to Petals and Prose. This is Helen Cannon.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Partners in Business Information Technology Conference with keynote speaker Tom Limoncelli, SRE at Stack Exchange, Thursday, February 26th at the USU Eccles Conference Center. Details at partners.usu.edu.